both on the men's and women's, I actually think there's more early round interesting matchups, popcorn matches, that we like to call it, in the locker room than you usually see. I mean, Sock Golbis, Florian Meyer, who won in Halle, rematch against Team, who he beat along the way. So you have some really interesting draws early on that, you know, aren't always the case with 32 seeds. And then same on the women. I mean, you have with Safarova playing Maddox Sands.
Right.
Some really interesting matchups, not just in the first round, but also possible third rounds and so forth. So there's some good early round matches.
Hey everyone, John Wertheim here. It is this week's Sports Illustrated Tennis Podcast. We're tracking this on a Friday shortly after the Wimbledon 2016 draw was released. Our guest this week is former player, coach, ATP board member as of this moment. You'll hear more about that later. Tennis Channel commentator, Southern California resident, Justin Gimelstob. We will go through the Wimbledon 2016 draw, talk about a few issues. Apologies in advance for the audio. Justin is in the UK. This was right before his ATP vote. I'm still in New York and head over tomorrow. So that's our disclaimer. But we talk about Wimbledon, talk about Novak Djokovic, a number of other current tennis topics. We'll continue this on the air on Tennis Channel starting Monday. But without further ado, let's bring him in to talk about Wimbledon 2016 in advance. Justin G, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Of course. Always fun to spend time with you.
Likewise. Let's just go right to storylines and the draw itself. And I think if you were going to sum up the men's side, it basically boils down to, does anyone beat our defending champion, winner of the last four majors, Novak Djokovic?
It's going to be a tough ask, but of all the majors, I do believe this is the one where he's most vulnerable, more so because the margins are smaller on the grass. And if he runs into a super hot player that's very aggressive and can play red line tennis, anyone would be vulnerable, even a player that is dominated as much as Djokovic has last year, play like, for example, Kevin Anderson, who was up 2-0 against him. I mean, I think those are the type of players that could make him a little bit vulnerable, the ones that could take the racket out of his hand. Fortunately, you know, if you look at his draw, he's got a pretty advantageous draw. He does have some big hitters in his quarter, Anderson, Raonic, and then obviously Federer's in his semifinal. I mean, I think that's a huge storyline as well. I think this tournament will give a big indication of where Roger's at and how competitive he could be at the highest level. Because of all the majors, there's no doubt that this is the one that he has the best chance of winning, not just this year, but throughout the remainder of his career. So when I look at Djokovic's draw overall on his half, the players that I feel like he's most vulnerable to are Anderson, Raonic, Federer, and Cilic, just because of their aggressive style and their comfort on the surface. But he's a prohibitive favorite.
You're taking him against the field?
I would take him against the field. I mean, I only think there's a handful of guys that could beat him. But this is the big one. I believe if he does win this one, he will win the U.S. Open and win the Slam, because winning best out of five against him on hard is a huge challenge. But if he gets through this one, I believe strongly that he'll win the Slam.
You see Raonic in his quarter, who of course has a new voice in his box, maybe in his head as well. What is the impact of bringing in a coach like that? I mean, we've seen a couple players do this in different situations, sometimes short-term, sometimes long-term. Do we overstate that? I mean, what is John McEnroe telling Milos Raonic at this stage in the game?
I think we overstate it at times, but I have to say, I mean, I broadcasted the whole week in Queens in the studio for Tennis Channel, and I was really impressed. Now, it's tough to make the direct correlations in such a short period of time, but there is no doubt that Raonic looked to be coming in more, looked to be using a slice backhand more, looked more comfortable transitioning. His net coverage was better. I mean, it's interesting when you think of their games are so contrasting, their personalities are so contrasting, but the things that McEnroe excelled at so much and became so natural at, how seamlessly he transitioned to the net, how soft his hands were, his anticipation, his ability to use his touch and be a presence, even though he wasn't half the physical specimen that Raonic was. it seemed like there was some things that translated immediately. And Round is just so professional, and he's such a sponge. He loves information, and he's so professional, and he's looking to improve every day. It seems like there's a lot of value there. And obviously, look, John is such a charismatic, powerful presence. There's no doubt that he'll have a huge influence. And Raonic played great in Queens. I mean, the guy did not lose serve. He was up 7-6, 3-0 against Murray in the final. Didn't lose serve until 3-1 up in the second, and Murray hit a clean winner on a first serve on the ad court wide. I mean, Raonic almost ran away with that tournament. It took an incredible effort by Murray to beat him. But once again, it just adds amazing storylines for people like you and I to have a Murray-Raonic final and a McEnroe-Lendl final going on at the same time is great for the sport.
You mentioned Federer, who, he beat Djokovic at the O2 in November. He has a very respectable Australian Open, and for multiple reasons, not least a knee injury that was sort of a fluke injury, we haven't heard much from him. What are we expecting, and how much, if this is a disappointing performance, how concerned do you become?
Well, I was surprised that he lost to Thiem and Zverev, frankly, but he hasn't played a lot of matches. He hasn't been that healthy this year. He did get a lot of matches in on the grass, which is helpful. Take this week off to regroup and recover. He's got a pretty advantageous draw. I mean, Doug Apolov is always a little bit of an... He's always dangerous because he's so talented, such a great athlete, such a big hitter. He has Jill Simone in his section. He's on Nishikori's quarter. I'm not overly concerned. The player that most concerns me in Federer's half is Cilic, just because he hits the ball so big. But I fully expect Federer to, especially with best out of five, playing here and being comfortable, having won seven times, I do expect there to be a Federer-Djokovic semifinal. But Father Time is undefeated, and how Roger's knee holds up, how he moves. I mean, his movement on the grass has always been such a strength.
Right.
And any issues with any lack of stability or any lack of comfort or any uncertainty in terms of the movement really exposes itself significantly on the grass. And a big part of Roger's game is his movement and being in position to execute his shots, because he plays a very aggressive style. It doesn't look that way because he has such great technique and balance.
All right, Justin, hold that thought. You are a basketball fan. I am a basketball fan. The NBA draft was just last night. We all know that the Cavs are the NBA champions. LeBron, in what is only described as a biblical story, has fulfilled his vow to Northeast Ohio. It's been a roller coaster ride. Andrew Sharp and Ben Golliver have been in the front row with their arms up in the air for that roller coaster ride. One of the worst analogies in sports. But they have one more episode left for Open Floor, their playoff podcast. You can find it at si.com/podcast or search for Open Floor on iTunes, Stitcher, or your favorite podcast app. How different does this draw look if we're playing best of three? I mean, you mentioned guys redlining. You mentioned a guy like Cilic. I mean, I feel like anyone can get hot for 45 minutes, but over a best of five, it's a much different calculus. How different do you think the draws of these majors look if we're playing best of three versus best of five?
Totally. Yeah, I completely agree. I mean, especially here, nowhere more than here. You would hear top players would want nothing to do, and generally top players don't want anything to do with best out of three in majors in general, because they want a bigger sample size. I mean, could you imagine having to play someone like Ernest Gulbis in best out of three in the second round of Wimbledon?
You mentioned Kevin Anderson, right?
Who would want to deal with that? Or even a Nicholas Mahut or a Karlovic or an Isner. I mean, Lucas Russell. I mean, who would want to deal with something like that? So Jules Mueller. I mean, it's Sam Groth even.
And the thinking is what?
The draw would look much different.
And the thinking is that best over five, those guys eventually sort of come off the boil, and the superior player, it's like coin flips, right?
I mean, yeah, it's just math. It's just law of averages. Right. It's just the longer time you have, the longer the law of averages kicks in.
Give me some. I mean, we Jamie, my producer, and I, we were talking about the draw a little bit, and you know, Taylor Fritz comes within a few kooky points of winning the juniors. Now he comes back this year as a big boy in the men's draw and gets Stan Wawrinka off the bat. Obviously, people are talking about Kyrgios Stepanek. Any other first round matches that jump out at you?
Well, I think there are. I mean, if both on the men's and women's, I actually think there's more early round interesting matchups, popcorn matches, that we like to call it in the locker room, than you usually see. I mean, Sock Golbis, Florian Meyer, who won in Halle, rematch against Team, who he beat along the way. As you mentioned, Wawrinka Fritz, Isner Bagdatis, even though John has dominated him in his head-to-head, Kyrgios Stepanek. And then some very interesting possible matches. Rasalk, Sam Querrey is a very interesting match. Shardy Bonfils is a very interesting match. So you have some really interesting draws early on that aren't always the case with 32 seeds. And then same on the women. I mean, you have with Safarova playing Maddox Sands.
Right.
You have some Allison Risk playing Vinci.
Wozniacki,
Kuznetsova,
right.
Shelby Rogers, Lisicki, Mikhail Hanchakova, so Muguruza and Georgie, I think, is quite interesting. Nicole Gibbs and Flipkins. You have some really interesting matchups, not just in the first round, but also possible third rounds and so forth. So there's some good early round matches.
Have you been on the grass? Have you played since you've been over there?
I haven't indoors. I was hoping to try and get on there yesterday. I've been a little bit busy with board meetings and my election in about 20 minutes for my board seat. But today's a beautiful day. It's been pretty rainy here, but the facility looks incredible as always. And this place is just magical.
I hear David Cameron's going to resign if you don't hold on to your board seat.
I heard Johnson. I heard the Boris Johnson is after it.
Yeah, exactly. Talk about the conditions, though. Do you think we've overestimated how the grass has been slowed down? I mean, what do you make of grass course tennis in 2016, especially at Wimbledon?
Definitely not. I mean, go back in YouTube video of Wimbledon 20 years ago or 30 years ago or 40 years ago, 15 years ago, and see. I mean, you couldn't stay back. And now it's the part about grass course tennis is the movement, the way the ball moves off the grass, the contours of the grass, the way you could use the grass on different shots. But in terms of the amount of tennis that's played in grass court tennis is so much more than it ever used to be. I mean, there used to be so few shots hit. It's a different form of grass court tennis. It's undeniable. Just go back and look at the videos.
But we were talking about the other day, and we were saying, you still find different winners, and a guy, Nicolas Mahut's a great example, or, Sam Stosur got to the semis at the French Open, she moves on to grass, and now she's struggling to win games. I mean, it does seem as though it still requires adjustment and favors some players more than others.
Oh, no, there's no doubt. I mean, but you look at the shot production, you look at players that are, their games adjust quicker. It's players that could use the slice, that transition better to the net. But those players always would have been successful on grass. The difference is you have a lot more players come into the fold that now could play on grass. I mean, you never would have seen a result where Cuevas, could have beaten Jules Muller on grass like he did in Nottingham.
Right, right.
That just never would have happened. I mean, you have a guy who's a pure clay courter, who's against a guy who's a pure fast court player. It wouldn't have happened. So it's much more homogenized, but doesn't mean the surface doesn't still favor certain players, or certain players don't adapt better or quicker or more easier or more easily.
All right, hold that thought. This is a reminder that on the SI Media podcast, my colleague Richard Deitch always has an insightful and entertaining guest. This week, it is Washington Post and ESPN magazine writer Eli Saslow. Eli will talk about how he made it to the Pulitzer Prize from his humble beginnings as a high school volleyball reporter in the Maryland suburbs. I thought he was from Colorado, Jamie. Is that not right? Anyway, we all start somewhere. And Eli started as a high school volleyball reporter, we're told. Again, that's the SI Media podcast with Richard Deitch. Find it on iTunes, Stitcher, or your podcast app of choice. And at si.com/podcast. Again, that's Eli Saslow with Richard Deitch. Let's talk women for a bit.
Okay.
Is it time to stop assuming Serena's going to win every major?
It is time to stop assuming that, but to counter that, she is still the odds-on favorite every year at every tournament as well. And you look at her draw, and there's some interesting storylines in her draw. She could have a rematch against Heather Watson. She could have a rematch against Mladenovic, who had that good match with her at the French. Right. And Heather Watson was within a couple points of beating her last year. Sloane Stephens is in her section. I think actually Coco Vandeweghe is a dangerous sleeper of mine. I think she has a good chance to get to the quarters. She's in Kvitova's section. And I'm a big believer in Madison Keys. I mean, I've followed her closely since she started working with Lindsay. I called some of her tennis last week when she won. Obviously she played well on the clay, and I think she's the second best female talent in terms of ball striking and athleticism. It's just a matter of how much she lets herself play. But I would love to see, and it'd be amazing for the sport, if you could have like a Madison Keys Mugu semifinal. And I don't think it's unbelievably unlikely.
What do you mean by that? Because I've heard that before. I've heard other people say that about Keys letting herself play.
Well, obviously we all deal with nerves, or we all deal with expectations, or whether it's injuries or mentally, or just shot selection or whatever. There's numerous parts of it, but with the overall concept of letting yourself play, just being relaxed enough where your talent and your true potential comes out, as opposed to, sometimes we self-sabotage or create obstacles that don't allow us to reach our potential or play up to our potential or do anything up to our potential.
I was listening to a discussion about soccer, and the point was raised that until there's a great, great player from the U.S., it's going to limit how much we may, follow this Euro 2016 and the Champions League, and it may be on in the bars, but until there is a great, great player from the U.S., it's going to sort of temper enthusiasm in the United States. We like our own. We like Americans to cheer for. Are we past that in tennis now, or do you think there is still this thirst and this starvation for an American champion after the Williams sisters that's necessary to sort of have tennis get to that next level? Or is 10, 12, 15 years of no American champion sort of inured us and tennis is now officially global?
I think it's all of those, actually. I don't think it's one or the other. I think it's all those. Tennis is officially global. I think we are conditioned to the fact that it's so international and that we embrace and accept and could enjoy great champions from other countries. But make no mistake about it, we want our own. We expect our own. We want our own. And in the sport, would, no matter how healthy it is, it would be more healthy and more exciting and more entertaining and more valuable if there are more American champions. There's no doubt about it. And I fully believe on the men's side there will be. It's going to take a little longer, but you have a great generation coming up. I fully believe that Madison Keys should be there for the women.
Madison Keys now a top 10 player as of a week ago. What do you think about this men's? I mean, I saw Francis Tiafoe failed to qualify. Fritz is firmly in the top 75 now. Has the misfortune, like we say, of drawing Stan Wawrinka off the bat, but he's made some quick adjustments since going pro. What else do you see? We keep hearing the cavalry's coming, but drill down a little more. I mean, what do you see among these four or five guys we're all talking about?
Well, one that isn't getting talked about as much because he's been injured, unfortunately, is the one who won Junior Wimbledon here last year, Riley Opelka,
yeah,
who beat Fritz in the semi. I mean, I love his game, especially on this surface. Unfortunately, he's been injured. But I think you're not going to see one player jump out more so than you saw Fritz. And I believe Fritz will be a top 10 player for sure. But when you look at Tommy Paul and Tiafoe, Kozlov, there's a lot of really, really good players. And it's just going to take them probably a little bit more time. And that's a byproduct of where the sport is at, and also the type of games they have and so forth. But there's some real positive storylines for sure.
Expand that globally. Zverev, Team Kyrgios, other. 5 years from now.
Zverev, I don't know that there's a more of a sure lock in the sport in a long time than there's been with Zverev. Team, to see him adjust to other surfaces as quickly as he has been impressive. I mean, Kyrgios, I believe, has the physical talent to be number one in the world, but we all know the variables and X factor with him, both good and challenging. George, I think, is a really, really good player. I would put him in a little bit below the others in terms of upside talent, but also I would put him right there in terms of professionalism, and the guy's going to be a top tier player for a long time, just based on his physical skills, his technical skills, and his desire to compete and his professionalism. And I think Fritz could be an absolute superstar.
All right, last question before you go to your election. If Djokovic and Serena are not winning it, who is?
Well, up till last week, I thought Federer was the number two favorite, but now I think it's Murray. I think actually he could do some things to Djokovic on this surface that would be more impactful than any other surface. And we saw here at Wimbledon in the final a couple of years ago, Djokovic has improved some of those things that Murray took advantage of, mainly the use of being able to defend the slice backhand. Djokovic's serve is better. But I still think if Murray plays his best, this is the best surface for him to beat Djokovic. And I think that he would have a chance. I think he would be the number two. And I believe that if it wasn't Serena, I believe that it would be someone, you know, a huge hitter. I think it would be someone like Muguruza or Keys. Again, I think so. Or Kvitova. I mean, that's a lot of people, but I'd probably put it, right. I'd put them all about the same, Mugu, Keys, and Kvitova. I also want to say one thing, looking at the draw, and I know I'm incredibly biased and I get hammered about it all the time, but actually this is going to be the year that Isner makes his run. I like his draw. I think that John has a very good chance to be playing Murray in the quarterfinal. So he's another sleeper of mine. He hasn't had a great year. He's lost a lot of close matches. I wouldn't be surprised if he broke through here and got to the quarters and played Murray.
What impact does losing those close matches have on a player? Because I mean, it's almost eerie.
I mean, you start seeing ghosts and you start developing scar tissue but the thing with John is he could turn it around just as quickly. And there's no one in the history of the sport that has played tennis with as close of matches as often as he has.
Right.
And he could flip it quickly. But there is no doubt, both from my time with him and just my experiences myself and all players, it's real. I mean, when you lose a bunch of close matches, it's, you know, it weighs on you, but there's only one way to get through it. And you just power through it, and you just have to give yourself the best chance and focus on the things you can control, all the cliches, but it's true. But as you know, in sports, winning breeds confidence breeds winning. The absence of them, you just have no choice but to put your head down and just try and just do whatever you can, scrape, dig, claw to get the momentum and get the ball rolling in a positive way.
All right. Go win your vote in a post-Brexit UK. See you in a few days.
I'll see you soon. See you. Thanks for having me on.
Thanks, buddy. All right. That's our tennis podcast for this week. I'm John Wertheim. That was Justin Gimelstob, our producer. As always, the lovely, the talented Jamie Lasanti. We will be continuing with these topics and seeing how Wimbledon 2016 unfolds in a few days, starting with first ball on Monday. We'll try to do another podcast or two from the All England Club. Thanks again. Your suggestions, as always, are welcome, as are your guest suggestions. We try to take as many of those into account as possible when we can arrange it. Again, apologies for the audio. As you could tell, Justin was heading off to his ATP vote. Busy times for him, busy times everywhere. We're eager to see how Brexit, which is dominating our social media feeds this morning, how Brexit will manifest itself at Wimbledon. But until next time, enjoy the tennis from the All England Club. Thanks for listening, and talk to you in 7 days.